This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Filmmaking, of course, an art all by itself. Lighting, cinematography, color palettes, the music, the stories, the acting. But what happens when the world of fine art and the world of filmmaking meet? This month on Movies on the Radio, we're not tackling the art of movie making, but making movies about art. And joining us to talk about their favorites and yours are Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University. Welcome back, Marcia.
Thank you so much, Frank.
And the ever-artistic Laura Boies, film curator from the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva film series screening at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
What about this? This is kind of interesting. We talked about, and we left it wide open for listeners, whatever you thought art was, whether it's music, visual art, sculpture. A lot of visual artists on the show today, but kind of interesting to see the way Hollywood treats the arts.
Well, of course, there's a huge range of the way art is imagined on film. There's the fictional iterations. There's all of the documentaries, a very rich documentary history having to do with the representation of art. And I think the thing I always think about when it comes especially to the biopics, I know we'll be talking about some of those today, is that there is a kind of difficult trap that filmmakers get into, which is, you know, art is necessarily a pretty boring process when you think about how it is made. And so whenever you're representing that in a film, you tend to have to shorthand the process, right? And then it becomes about the life. And often that's like the struggle for success, the failures, the drug and alcohol, the relationships falling apart. So it can fit into those biopic tropes that get a little bit tired. So it's always interesting to see when filmmakers think about a way out of that kind of boring path.
Well, full disclosure right up front, I went to art school, and I am so totally over propping up the ego of male artists that a number of these films bring on a kind of PTSD from my own personal experience. Mm. So you will see that reflected in the coming discussion.
I will just say, I just saw recently in an opinion section of the New York Times, and the headline was, "You want to make money in art, invest in women artists." Yeah, that's what it said.
It's about time.
Not front page, but the opinion page. But anyway, go ahead. Things have changed. So there's that. I mean, the fact is, if you're going to do movies about artists, it's probably going to be men. That's part of our problem, and at least in the history of filmmaking.
Yes, certainly that's true. And we're going to be discussing a number of them.
One of the dead white men that comes up first, of course, is Vincent Van Gogh, dead at his own hand, we think. But a fascinating character. I think it gets to some of what you were saying, Marcia, is that the story itself, I mean, the novel Lust for Life, very successful novel, his story so rich, why not tell it? And there's two takes on this. So why don't we listen to two different versions, two different films, and we'll start with Larry Wheeler, who knows a bit about art and movies, talking about Loving Vincent.
I'm Larry Wheeler, director of the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. And one of my favorite movies about art and artists is a recent film done by Polish filmmakers called Loving Vincent. It's a fascinating film. Not only does it treat the very serious and controversial subject of Van Gogh's suicide or probable suicide, this idea is explored by the various people in the community where he died. But the medium is animation, and it's composed of something like 165,000 different images, all of which are actual paintings done by 150 different artists around the world. And when you're watching the film, you think you are watching Van Gogh paintings parading in front of your eyes that tell a story in animated form. It's just beautiful to watch. It's poetic in the way the discussion of his death and the people involved in his life at the end of his life come together.
His neighbors and the police.
Get out of there!
And the whole town against an ill man.
Vincent, what have you done?
We all knew something was very wrong.
Vincent!
from the movie Loving Vincent, an animated biography of Vincent Van Gogh and the favorite when it comes to art movies of Larry Wheeler, director of the North Carolina Museum of Art. What do you think of this film?
Well, what I find interesting about it is that it is a film that is attempting in a very original way to find a form that expresses something about the artist that is unconventional, which is to literally imagine the visual atmosphere of the film in terms of the painting style of the subject. What's interesting to me is that the narrative itself I found fairly dissatisfying, in as much as it's kind of like a policier, it's like a Rashomon style, what happened, this happened. But the animation style is so innovative that I think that really kind of erases some of what I found to be dissatisfying about the storytelling of the film.
Well, it kind of speaks to the problem that you mentioned, how it's so difficult to convey the creative process. And then I sat down at the piano, or it's, and then I wrote kind of thing. And in this way, the animators are trying to get to the subject by actually recapitulating the artistic process that Van Gogh went through. Which I think is really pretty fascinating.
And, you know, you had said, oh, there's these two films. Well, actually, Robert Altman also did Vincent and Theo. And, I mean, this happens to be, I think, because the artist is also, he's such an iconic figure in the history of art. I mean, if you were to ask, you know, a 10-year-old, name five artists, this is probably one of the artists you would get. But then also, I think in our culture, we value so much the kind of idea of the tortured artist.
Right.
And that's part of what this, you know, film is getting at, is this tortured soul and trying to understand what happened to him in his final days and final months.
And talk about innovative ways of rendering all of that. One would be to use the style of the artist, a kind of visual representation. The other is to use the craft of filmmaking itself to see if you can, in some ways, recreate what the artist did on a canvas. And that comes up in the film Lust for Life.
My name is Alex Marsh, and I'm calling from Raleigh. My favorite film about art is Lust for Life. It was released in 1956, and it stars Kirk Douglas as Vincent Van Gogh and Anthony Quinn as Paul Gauguin. Both actors are really good in the film, especially Kirk Douglas, who has a natural resemblance to Van Gogh and really expresses Vincent's passion and torment.
No matter how often I fail, there is something in me. But this is not the way to find it. Hiding away here, wasting your time. You've become an idler.
An idler? Yes. But there are two kinds of idlers. There's the man who's idle because he wants to be. Out of laziness, how easy that is. I envy him. But there's the other kind. The man who's idle in spite of himself. I want nothing but to work. Only I can't. I'm in a cage. A cage of shame and self-doubt and failure. Somebody, believe me.
But the real star of the film to me is the cinematography, lighting, and set design. It was shot on location in Holland and France, and the filmmakers went to great lengths to accurately recreate the scenes, colors, and emotions of Van Gogh's paintings. So I feel like I'm actually stepping into his paintings when I watch the film.
1956 film Lust for Life.
Yes, I would completely agree with that last comment. When in the early part of the films, he's in the Netherlands with the potato fields, everything is very gray and brown, and then it transitions into these other color environments, so you get an idea of the perception of Van Gogh as he was painting. However, Kirk Douglas's performance is a little much for me.
Well, it's a 1950s performance, and I mean, I think the style of acting was very different in the 1950s, but I do think what the film does is it's incredibly sympathetic towards this figure, and I mean, I think you see that coming across in Loving Vincent, because part of it is told from the perspective of someone who has no sympathy towards Vincent, and then kind of develops this empathy by the end of the film, and I think that brings up this idea of the misunderstood artist, which is another reason, right, the tortured artist, the misunderstood artist, that this figure has been so cinematized and imagined in that way.
Yeah,
well, and it's because his paintings really speak very directly to contemporary audiences. Nobody ever, you know, says, yeah, I just don't get that sunflower thing. You know, people really do feel an emotional connection to them.
Yeah, well, what's amazing is that these artists, as you say so often, the story is about the artist ahead of his time, and mostly his time when these films were being made. And then we empathize. Oh, why couldn't those morons see the brilliance? Right. And of course, that's exactly what you do in contemporary art, is we kind of dismiss all of that. So it's always comical to me to have to go back in time to find the misunderstood artist when the artists are in our midst being misunderstood even as we speak.
Well, and I think in point of fact, the whole genre of the biopic, whether it's about an artist or a musician or any kind of figure, part of the story is all of the people that misunderstand them and don't recognize them, and then how they transcend that, and then typically how they, you know, fall into a terrible state at the end of their lives.
Well, there's an episode of Doctor Who where they go back in time and they hang out with Vincent van Gogh, and then they bring him forward so that he can see that all his suffering is worthwhile, that he's going to be considered the greatest painter in history. And there's something very satisfying, although
about
perhaps
that
juvenile
fantasy.
And then he looks
it.
At a Jackson Pollock and he said, a monkey could have done that. That's how that
we'll get to that later.
We'll talk about that. Movies on the Radio this month. Your favorite movies about art and artists. Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys are with me as always. Marcia, the film professor at North Carolina State University. A film professor at North Carolina State University, but in our hearts, the film professor. Laura Boys is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Diva film series curator, which screens at the Carolina Theater. We'll talk about that and much, much more on the state of things. It's Movies on the Radio, Art in the Movies, the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio today, our topic, your favorite movies about art and artists. Joining me are film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. And you, we called in and called out to people who, many of whom were in the art business, to talk about their favorite films that centered on art. And here's one.
My name is Roger Manley. I'm the director of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at NC State University. And my choice for a movie about art and artists is a 1991 film called The Object of Beauty. It takes place in London, and John Malkovich and Annie McDowell star as a sort of high-flying couple that has run out of money. And they cook up a scheme to raise money by faking the theft of a small bronze sculpture that her first husband gave her. And their plan is to pretend that it was stolen and then cash in on the insurance value of the piece. But in the process of getting ready to fake this theft, it actually is stolen, but by a deaf chambermaid who works at the hotel that they're staying at. Eventually, the piece turns up again, and the chambermaid is confronted by the insurance agents, who ask her why she stole it if she wasn't planning to sell it.
Why?
What's it say?
It says, because it spoke, and I heard it.
I think it's a great film about art because it gets at a range of ways people think about art as an investment, as a commodity, as a token of love. It's a status symbol, but most important, it talks about the one-to-one communication and work of art.
That's from the movie 1991 film, The Object of Beauty, starring John Malkovich and Andy McDowell.
So I didn't see this film, although I would like to, especially now after I've heard Roger talk about it. But I do think one of the interesting things to think about with art in general, and then the way that movies imagine it, is that it is taste. I mean, of course, there's the accepted commercial hierarchy where things get, you know, kind of outsized values, especially in the modern contemporary art world. But when it comes down to it, we all respond, if we're honest about it, we all respond to art in very subjective, individual ways. So I love the idea of a film that takes this idea of this, you know, very, very valuable object, and then somebody who just connects with it because it's a thing of beauty or a thing of at least interest to them. Yeah.
Well, it's very odd to think about assigning a work of art a price tag. I mean, what the value of something beautiful or not beautiful I mean, there are so many people that buy and sell art just for its value without any consideration of the aesthetics at all. And I find that to be appalling.
Well, yeah, but it's been with us since at least the 50s when Forbes magazine recommended the kinds of art that you invest in, right?
Right.
And so, but it also, I think the problem in some ways is the way we try to understand art. I mean, there is this stuff out there in cultural production that moves us. I don't know what that is. There is entertainment, there, which is an artistic creative process by which you create a popular song that has little or no meaning. It's about losing your boyfriend or girlfriend. And yet it, you know, it's cultural production and you like it and it takes talent. Does everything that takes talent, is that art, or does it have to move me? And then if I can actually sell it for money, does it somehow diminish the value? I mean, that's our problem with the word art. We need more words. That's what we need.
We really? Do we need more words?
We need a radio artist, perhaps, to create the vocabulary to properly identify.
But we also have such a fascination. I mean, this is a kind of global fascination, I think, with the way some art becomes so hyper valuable. I think it's why we get so entranced by these crazy stories of people, you know, stealing art from, you know, high profile art from museum collections and what happens to it and when it gets returned. I mean, every now and then one of those stories crops up, right? And I mean, there have been many films where art is the object of a caper, as this one that Roger just talked about.
My name is Alan Teasley from Durham, North Carolina, and the film I thought of immediately about arts and artists is The Draftsman's Contract, Peter Greenaway's 1982 movie. Actually, I saw it like four times the year it came out, and I really remembered loving the setup of the whole thing, where this draftsman comes and is going to do a series of drawings of this estate, and he has this framing device that's like 4x3, and he puts it up so that he can get everything just exactly right.
For drawing number 6, from 6 o'clock in the evening until 8 o'clock, the lower lawn of the garden by the statue of Hermes will be kept clear of all members of the household, staff, horses, and other animals.
Philip, go and ask those people to move. And ask them nicely, and smile. Don't trot.
But then when I looked it up and started reading about it yesterday, it turns out that it's a murder mystery and quite sexually provocative and all that. So that's probably more what I liked about it than the art. But still, I think its portrayal of the artist's hero is really fun.
It's called The Draftsman Contract, 1982.
I love an honest caller.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, Peter Greenaway, who is, you know, a British filmmaker whose films are very much made in the tradition of art. I mean, he's a filmmaker who's had patronage, so he could really make very artistic films. They're not as commercial as certainly a Hollywood film. And this film is filled with a lot of pretense about this very kind of indulgent world. But I do, the best scenes are, in fact, to my mind, the scenes of drawing and watching him go through this process of rendering this estate while this woman's husband is out of town. And they're, you know, it's a tawdry picture. I will not lie.
Well, without the story, they'd all be lost. But yeah, Laura.
And it has really superb wigs and costumes,
man.
Too, really.
These are real dandies and macaroni.
Yes, exactly true.
That's good stuff. Well, and that's it, too. And it's the artifice. It's about creating the thing, right?
Right.
And that becomes, there are a lot of films that are about that. What happens when your real life becomes rendered as an artifact.
Well, but Greenaway also, I will say this, I mean, I think his mode of filmmaking is to think about the creating a kind of an aesthetic that is that pushes his films into the realm of being quote-unquote art films. That's like almost a whole other category, right? Not what we're talking about today. But he does try to make the form in the service, I think, of that idea of something that's not as commercial.
My name is John Bierman. I live in Hillsboro, and I'm an artist. My favorite movie about artists of all time is A Horse's Mouth, a 1958 film. It stars Alec Guinness, and he is phenomenal. I think he's one of my favorite actors of all time. The very first shot of this incredible film is a shot of a mud puddle in urban kind of down and out neighborhood in London, again in the late 50s. And about 2 or 3 seconds later, a baby carriage goes right over this mud puddle. And that is, I think, the central dynamic or metaphor of this whole film, which is creativity is surrounded with messiness and destruction and all of that in this whole movie. So the movie is about kind of a stereotypical starving artist, down and out, and it's really about his pursuit of painting, and particularly he's painting several different paintings on the wall.
You've got your whale upside down.
But Mr. Jimson, surely a whale doesn't have its eye under its jaw, does it?
None of your sarcasm now. My whales do, otherwise they wouldn't be real. They'd just be pictures out of a whale book.
Shall I try and reverse it?
Not now, it's too late. No, 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 Flo. Learn when to leave well alone.
You mean it's finished?
Finished.
Straight from the Horse's Mouth, out of film 1958, starring Alec Guinness and Kay Walsh.
Do you need solitude and peacefulness in order to be a productive artist? They often have extremely chaotic personal lives, and yes, somehow creativity still happens.
So I had never seen this film until last week. I saw it for the first time. I am so grateful that I did. It is a wonderful film. And one of the things that I like about it is this is not the kind of romantic figure that you see in a film and go, oh, God, what a wonderful life. It is an unromantic, romantic in that way, kind of portrayal of what it means to be an artist, of this uncompromising, at times boorish, ridiculous, but also a dreamer and somebody who has this commitment to making work a certain way, who really does not care. And so that is the unromantic romanticness of it. And I think it's very funny. It's very witty. And it's just, and Alec Guinness is tremendous in it.
The romantic part is this feeling that we all have, this attraction to the free spirit.
Right.
Right. The person who would actually bulldoze the art moments after they
break into someone's apartment and make art on their walls while
that's
they're out
right.
of town.
So that speaks to the creative impulse. I'm going to make the thing, and I don't really care what happens to it or who likes it. And then, of course, there's cultural production, which is, again, an artistic process by which I create a popular song, then my patrons are the folk who will buy this thing in big numbers. Is that art? Well, yeah. I mean, not everybody can do, you know, those pop songs. But the fact is you have written it for a group of people. And because you want it to be a success, is that art? And I think this film shines a light on that very question, in the sense that there are these two camps that have to compete throughout.
Well, and it's also about kind of the establishment of art that is monetarily valuable and recognized in museums, and art that is not, because it is outside of that. And at the end, when there's this major exhibition of Jimson's work, it kind of comes full circle as he rides off to the next adventure.
I'm Daniel Johnson, a huge movie fan, and I have a blog called Film Babble Blog. It's all about reviews and interviews and whatnot. And my choice for favorite art film would be Pollock, which is Ed Harris's portrait of Jackson Pollock. And it really struck me, the sequences in which it depicts the process of making art. Harris did his own drip art throughout the film, recreating the works of Jackson Pollock. And it's really, it's not just the process of the painting and those scenes. It was also really a passion project that really made a great portrait of the man, and one that really stuck in the memory for me.
I thought I knew all the abstract artists in New York, and I don't know Jackson Pollock.
What do you think of Picasso?
It has been.
De Kooning.
He's all right. He's learning.
What's she doing here?
You need to get cleaned up.
I have just climbed up and down five flights of stairs. I'm Peggy Guggenheim.
They're sorry.
My God, and you're drunk.
No.
No.
What you're doing is the most original
and vigorous art in the country.
We're broke.
You just keep at it.
I'm keeping at it. Don't tell me to keep at it.
From the movie Pollock, starring Ed Harris, and Movies on the Radio, Marsha Gordon, Laura Boyes, and you.
I have a story to tell about this. Well, it's not my connection, but my colleague Susan M. Schwiller, who teaches screenwriting at NC State, actually wrote the screenplay for Pollock. And so I was asking her if she had any behind-the-scenes kind of stories to tell about it. And she was telling me that while she was writing it, she actually went to Long Island, New York, where Pollock lived and had his studio, and that is now a museum and research center, which I did not know. And apparently the studio and the house are as Pollock left it. You have to put booties on if you want to go in the studio because there's paint splattered on the floor. And so all of the exteriors for the film and the studio as well were shot there. And then what they did is they just recreated the interiors in a Brooklyn studio to shoot the interiors there. But she said she really got a lot of inspiration from actually going to the place while she was writing.
Hasn't the paint dried yet?
It has not dried yet.
So, and one has to ask, so if you have this long sequence where Ed Harris is painting a Jackson Pollock and it looks like a Jackson Pollock, so what is the value of his painting?
Well, and that's the Andy Warhol question, and that's the you know, the Gully Jimson question, and that's the great question about art, is what's the value of the original and of reproductions, and why are things valuable if one person touches it and not if someone else does?
Because there was an exhibition of forgeries at the museum a while ago. And I was fascinated. So if something is, it's a Rembrandt, it's worth so much money. And then in 1973, somebody says, oh, that's not a Rembrandt. And it's only worth a fraction of it,
right.
But it was worth so much more just because it has some, I mean, you're telling me that there is no aesthetics, it's only a commodity. It's very confusing.
Well, but that's because you think that somehow aesthetics is a thing that you're born with, but it actually is very much shaped like by your cultural context, right? And that includes, in a consumer culture like ours, everything you do has a price tag, and everything you consider, even your aesthetics, are associated with price because your cultural context has shaped you that way.
Right. Absolutely. And also, I mean, we live in a culture of celebrity, and we value that relationship.
Certainly true.
If the celebrity has touched it, then it is a valuable thing. And that counts for the art world as well.
Right. Even if it's just their handkerchief.
I mean, if you think about cultures in which, sort of pre-agricultural cultures in which certain dramatic representations, right, you can talk about voodoo or some of the other ways in which a shaman will recreate an act and create a lot of music and noise. Within that culture, it has powerful meaning and can actually do things. It can actually have power. Outside of that culture, it's meaningless. And so we're moved and not moved by things precisely because of the way, you know, we were trained.
Well, which is also why, I mean, getting back to kind of the real world, there's those stories every year or so, right? Somebody goes to a thrift store and spends $2 on a painting, and next thing you know, it's sold at auction for $300 million. And so it's that idea of the value of something if you can tie it back to the maker, and the maker is valuable.
My name is Sydney Shear, and I'm interim department head at Santa Fe Community College in the jewelry design program. When asked about favorite films with art, Frida came to mind immediately. I loved everything about this movie, including the music from Lila Downs. But I think the things that stand out were the movements that she would turn and the whole scenario would change. And it was sort of choreographed so beautifully that way. And I also loved the whole scenarios when she was painted and then her paintings moved into the movie. And when I read that was not done on a computer, they actually sat there and painted her, that even made it better. Her imagery as a painter were also really, have always been really compelling to me, because she was the muse behind Diego Rivera, who was really well known, but I think she was arguably far more talented.
These are good, Frida. I love them.
You were probably painting better when you were 12.
It's nonsense. I could never paint like this. I'm good, I'm serious. I paint what I see, the world outside. With you paint from here. It's wonderful.
Clip from the film Frida, 2003.
Yes, I really love Frida. It's one of my favorite films about artists because, unusually, it is about a female artist, Salma Hayek, really did a wonderful job as far as recreating Frida's look and Alfred Molina playing Diego Rivera. Although I have to say, now that I know the compromises that she had to make with Harvey Weinstein to get this made, it it taints it a little for me.
Well, and it was directed by Julie Taymor, so it was also directed by a woman, which I think is important to add. What I remember from it, it's been a while since I've seen it, are the vibrant colors, really vibrant, and then some really cool animation sequence like that skeleton anime, which I think the brothers Quay might have actually done some of the animations.
There are some really great animations. There's a sequence where she goes to watch King Kong and then visualizes Diego Rivera conquering New York like King Kong. It's really great.
Movies on the Radio, Marcia Gordon, Laura Boies. We're talking about art represented in the art of filmmaking. Laura Boies, of course, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon, a film professor at NC State. Just ahead, high art in the films on the ever artful State of Things. Stay tuned, please. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Movies on the Radio today, going through your picks for favorite movies about art and artists. I'm joined by film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Marcia is a film professor at NC State, Laura, film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art, and curator for the Movie Diva film series at the Carolina Theater. And this month, as we say, we're talking about representations of art and artists in the movies.
My name is Kristen. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and my favorite art film is High Art, and it has a personal significance to me for a couple of reasons. One is that the star of the film, arguably Ally Sheedy, it was a comeback role for her, and I used to teach the film here in New York where she lives, and she would come and speak to my classes about it. And she was terrific and very profound and subtle in her understanding of her character, Lucy. And I love the film because it's a rare film about a woman artist, directed by a woman artist. And it offers a lovely yet dark take on a woman artist trying to be herself while making art. And how difficult that is, and it causes her ultimately to retreat from that world because she thinks those two things are incompatible.
I have a love issue and a drug problem, or maybe I have a love problem and a drug issue. I don't know.
I can't help you with that.
Clip from the film High Art.
So this was Lisa Chilodenko's first feature film. She actually started the script while she was at Columbia University. And I remember really loving this film when it came out. It's also the first time I remember seeing Patricia Clarkson. So in addition to Ally Sheedy, it has a very strong female-centric cast. And I agree with Kristen that it's this great combination of really being focused on the kind of the ideals and what it means to be an artist, but it's not some kind of optimistic imagining of it. As a matter of fact, it's really a pretty sad film when it all comes down to it.
Any significance that this is also Ally Sheedy's comeback role in a lot of ways? And again, this is sort of the art and the artist and the struggling artist kind of rendered for real in real life. And then again in the story.
Well, of course, Ally Sheedy had been a big star in all of those 1980s films and Breakfast Club. And I don't really know what happened exactly, but I know that she receded from her screen career, whether that was because she was not getting roles or chose not to take them. But I kind of love that this is the film she came back with because it is precisely about trying to figure out a way to navigate your kind of public art life.
Fame is not forever.
Ooh. Ooh, we're going to etch that one here in the acetate that is our film program. Let's move on to another film.
My name is Mark Hewitt, and I'm a part of living in Chatham County. And my favorite movie about art is Ugetsu, a Japanese movie made in the 1950s. And it's a tale of two brothers, one a potter and one a samurai. He's a peasant who wants to be a samurai, and that's during a time of turmoil. And the potter takes wares to a local market, makes a lot of money, comes back, starts making more pots, hoping to make lots of money. And a very beautiful, wealthy woman asks him to bring pots to her castle and seduces him. And at one point, he is so thrilled by all of this that he declares that the value of people and things truly depends on their setting. And many artists feel that way. And I think it's actually false. You don't need to have pots in museums. You can have them in the floor of the back of a car, and they can still look good. And anyway, it's a tale of ambition, and it's a tale of male sort of greed and excessive pride in work. And it's in that way, it's a morality tale. And it seems to me one of the morals of the story is to really enjoy the place you are and enjoy the act of making and not worry too much about the rest.
That is North Carolina potter Mark Hewitt from about the 1953 movie Ugetsu, Japanese film.
There are not a lot of movies about ceramic artists, I have to say.
So of the films we're talking about today, I just want to say this is by far the most beautiful. Please, if you have an interest in seeing a film from today's show, see Ugetsu. It's a Mizoguchi film. One of my favorite scenes from this film is when the invading army is coming through and he has just fired his kiln, the potter. He's like a farmer, though, who wants to be more of a potter than a farmer. And he flees, and he's so panicked about leaving because he doesn't want his pots to be ruined, and he comes back and they've just been fired enough. And shortly after that, there's these invading army pillagers, and they go storming through his place and they start breaking pottery and they leave and they go, nothing but pots doesn't mean anything. So it's all about how we value these things differently. So it's getting at some of the things we've been talking about, actually.
Laura, your pick was the film Untitled.
What attracts me to his work is how uncomfortable it makes me feel. This, to me, is a sign of quality.
You have an eye.
He sees the mystery in the material world.
I want my work to have the whole world in it, and I want it to mean everything to everyone. But I don't want to add anything. I want to be loved.
Genius.
Can't you give us any meaningful feedback?
Stupid! A man kicking a can?
It's a bucket, but...
Please. Not another, but is it art discussion? Who are we to judge what will stand the test of time? That's for the ages.
So you get the idea. Untitled, right?
It's a satire of the art world starring Andy Goldberg as an extremely unsuccessful composer who meets a gallery owner who realizes that if he's making something difficult and unlikable, he should be in an art gallery and not in a concert hall. And it's about, it is a lot about commodification, but it's also how to get pleasure out of being an artist, even if you don't have that kind of monetary success.
Commodification and the pretense. Once you realize it's about the money, everybody's got to keep up the appearances, right? And
right. So, this is all about pretension, this whole film.
Great stuff. Let's talk about yours. House of Wax is a film. Marcia?
You gave my punchline away. No, I'm kidding. So I went with something a little irreverent. Mm-hmm. House of Wax, for those of you who have not had the privilege of seeing this film, is a 1953 quote-unquote horror film starring Vincent Price. And it's a 3D film. And so if you're wondering when you're watching it why this film about a wax sculptor has a long scene of paddleball, it's because it would have been more impactful to see it in 3D. This is the beginning of Vincent Price's horror film career. And he makes these very lifelike wax figures in the film.
I came to get the books. I want to study our account.
Well, we've been doing very well lately. Over 200 paid admissions today.
Do you call that good Saturday business? You weren't so stubborn, we'd be turning them away from here weekends. Who cares a hang about history and wax?
There are people in the world who love beauty.
But more who want sensation, shock.
Morbidly curious. I won't cater to them.
Their money's as good as anybody else's. You should have seen them turning away at that wax museum on 23rd Street tonight, the Eden Musée. The story's the same at Madame Tussauds in London. You'd only listen to me, Jack.
I know, Matthew. I'd put in a chamber of horrors. Murder, torture, execution. Scare the living daylights out of people. I don't care for that kind of patronage.
So on the one hand, this is just a really fun irreverent kind of film about some very strange doings in this museum. But on the other hand, it also really is a film about artistic ideals and about realism and about the commerce of the museum world, which is significant. And I also think it's worth considering because Vincent Price was a very serious art collector. In the 1960s, he actually had a line of art supplies that was marketed through the Sears catalog and also a collection of what was referred to as original fine art that you could get through the Sears Easy payment plan. And I've done some research into this. It's really interesting because Price is marketed as an art authority and people could buy quote-unquote original Picassos and original, you know, very well-known artists and put it on a payment plan. So it was about marketing art to the masses. And that was a very 1950s, 1960s idea. So
there's also a comedy version of this film, which is Bucket of Blood, done by Roger Corman, which is a satire of kind of the beatnik art world. And once again, the whole idea that a sculpture is most lifelike if there's a corpse inside.
This would be a good double feature.
And Theater of Blood with Vincent Price, where he plays the actor who is, you know, hurt by the art critics.
Yes,
and
right.
And takes his revenge.
Right.
This is a series now.
The famous dog-eating scene, which we don't have today. Instead, we'll go on to the film, Maudie.
Hi, this is Martha Bader. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm going to tell you quickly about my favorite movie, Maudie. It's about an artist who's a folk artist based in Nova Scotia. It's based on a true story, and it covers her life and how she became an artist, her undying love of just creating beautiful things out of a place that wasn't always so beautiful for her. It also shows her relationship in this small folk town and how it makes you feel. And that's what art is. It just really makes you feel the highs, the lows. You can get into her character and into her artwork. And everything is so real and authentic, which is the beautiful big mess of art that I love.
Oh, isn't she beautiful?
Yeah, I'm finished.
And this tree has red leaves.
This one has green.
Mm-hmm.
What season is it?
Well, I guess it's everything that's pretty about all seasons.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how much? Hmm? How much?
No.
What's your price?
$5.
Done.
None?
No. No. No, I'm not selling it.
It's all right.
Not selling that one.
Already sold.
I'm finished it. I haven't finished it.
Oz, just pulling your leg now. It's a joke. This one's not for sale.
2016 movie Maudie.
Well, in the documentary world, there are so many films about outsider artists. And this is a rare fictional version of that kind of story.
Yeah. What comes to mind immediately for me is Rocket to Rainio, which is a lovely film made by North Carolina filmmaker Brett Ingram about Rinaldo Kuehler, who was an illustrator at the North Carolina Museum of Sciences, who created a whole universe in his spare time, largely coming out of a place of trauma and insecurity that he used his art to kind of imagine an alternative universe that he had more control over. And it's very moving.
Junebug is another film filmed
in
North Carolina.
That's
in
right.
part. That was a film that was done there. And well, let's move on to another film as well.
My name is Susan Fellman, and I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina, where I'm a professor of art history and film and media studies, and I pay a lot of attention to movies about artists. And a movie I really like about artists is An Unmarried Woman, which was directed and written by Paul Mazursky and came out in 1978. In this movie, Alan Bates plays a painter named Saul Kaplan. And Erica, who is the unmarried woman of the title, a character played by Jill Clayburgh, gets involved with him after a few bumpy trial runs at having a relationship after her divorce from her husband. And I really like this movie artist for a few reasons. One is that he really goes against the stereotypical movie artist. Also, what I love about it is that the painter's works are really good. This painter, Saul Kaplan's works, are played by paintings by Paul Jenkins, who was a serious American abstract painter. He did kind of gorgeous color field paintings. So it's a really good film about with an artist character, but it's also a really good film about art. And another thing that I think is really interesting is that the particular aspect of these pictures, even though they're abstract, or maybe because they're abstract, also sort of expresses the feelings of joy and liberation and sexual exploration and excitement that the character Erica begins to experience in her life as a single person and as a lover as she recovers from the blow of being left by her husband.
The sex was very good.
I want you. You know that.
Yes, I'm getting the message.
Do you want me?
My head tells me to slow down. Am I only a sexual object to you?
Now you're a bright, willful, curious woman. Who is also a sexual object?
La-da-da, 1979, An Unmarried Woman.
Well, and the other kind of key issue at play here is that she works in a gallery. The unmarried woman works in a gallery. So she is constantly surrounded by these artists and by this art. And so part of her kind of transition from this place of thinking she's in a happy marriage to being left to finding herself is played out through this community. And so obviously gallery owners, gallery workers are a big part of this equation between artists and the museum world and all of the commerce that happens.
Well, this was a really influential work of second wave feminism, where a woman is, you know, quote unquote, liberated and has to find her way in the world. But as I recall, does she find her solution in Alan Bates?
Not exactly. No, it's left a little bit indeterminate in the end.
Because I remember
she gets a big painting out of it, though.
She gets a big painting. A big painting, is that a euphemism?
It is not.
Not the size of the brush, you know, Laura.
Because I remember thinking of being a little bit disappointed that another man seemed to be the solution to her problem.
But I believe that that she does not, in the end, just kind of go running off with him. He propositions her to have this other life, and she says, no, I've got to kind of stay here and get my act together. So
I'm glad to hear that I misremember it.
It's 1979. This art was a work in progress, and we've seen some progress has been made since then, we hope.
Some.
We hope. I want to thank you both. It's been great.
Thank you, Frank.
Our guest today, movie experts Marcia Gordon, Laura Boyes, Marcia, film professor at North Carolina State, Laura, the film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art, and the curator of the Movie Diva film series screening at the Carolina Theater. Laura's going to be hosting a screening of Born Yesterday at the Carolina Theater tonight, 7 o'clock, part of that Movie Diva film series. That's a good film, right?
Yes. Oh, it's excellent. Very topical.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that. Our next episode, we want to hear about your favorite TV actors who have moved, turned movie stars, or the other way. If they were in the movies and then had good TV careers, people have made the transition one way or the other between TV and movies. We'd love to hear who those actors are, and if you've got a favorite film or TV show, you'll want to mention that too. That's the next Movies on the Radio, SOT at WUNC.org or hashtag SOT Movie. Thanks a million. That's the state of things for today. Our program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service with the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.